Welcome to Notes from the Electronic Cottage. I'm Jim Campbell. On a recent edition of the Electronic Cottage, we listed three of the most common questions that we receive. To recap, they are question one, what is private on the web? Our answer, essentially nothing. Question two, what is secure on the web? Our answer again, essentially nothing. Third question, what can we do to reduce the likelihood of identity theft, straight-ahead theft, and having our innermost thoughts and concerns hung out on the web like wet laundry on a summer day? In a previous program, we looked at questions one and two, and why our opinion is that essentially nothing on the web is secure, and therefore nothing on the web is, despite advertisements and protestations from service providers to the contrary, really private. What then can a regular person do if she or he wants to reduce, if not eliminate entirely, some of the bad effects of using the web that's become so much a part of our daily lives? The most obvious way to escape some of the very bad possible effects of using the web is simply not to use it. But that, for most people, is not a very acceptable solution. How about using the web and using things that are connected to the web, such as credit card purchases, more sparingly? That could certainly be helpful. As we've mentioned on previous episodes, companies, healthcare providers, even governments, assure us that our information is secure with them and that any data that's released is anonymized, so we don't have to worry about our lifestyles, our medical records, our buying habits, or anything else being identified with us personally. We've also seen that such claims of data anonymization are extremely suspect. One researcher at Rutgers University, for example, was able to identify 90% of users in a credit card database using only four records of purchases, and those with card users' names, addresses, account numbers, and other personally identifying information completely removed. Bottom line, we're wise to assume that any time we choose to do anything on the web, or that is connected to the web, what we do is or could be identifiable. Period. Sad to say, there's little that we can do to avoid the almost daily breaches of our personal data held by companies, healthcare organizations, and even government organizations that we interact with, other than exert pressure on them as customers to demand that they take data security much more seriously. And of course, on a personal level, we can keep to a very minimum the personal data that we provide them with in the first place. Just because we're asked for personal data doesn't mean that we have to hand it over. At a time when 1,800 personal records are stolen every minute of every day, we may wish to pay a bit more attention to what we choose to do or say on the web, when we choose to use credit or debit cards rather than cash, and what type and amount of information we choose to hand over in commercial, medical, or even government transactions. On a personal level, the most common activities on the web involve sending messages through email, through text on mobile devices, and either via the web or via wireless phone channels, making phone calls. All are a great convenience. In the wake of Edward Snowden's revelations about the surveillance activities of the National Security Agency, however, a lot of people have gotten a whole lot more concerned about their phone calls and email interactions being collected by the government. Incidentally, despite the current administration's pledges over a year ago to do away with universal phone and email monitoring of Americans under Section 215 of the Patriot Act, those activities are still underway with no additional oversight whatsoever. And the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, which has to approve such activities, has, as of March 1, 2015, once again rubber-stamped the NSA's request to continue such surveillance. That's really no surprise to anyone, since only the government can appear before the court. And the government seems to think such surveillance is perfectly in keeping with our Fourth Amendment to the Constitution and totally appropriate for a country which bills itself as the land of the free. It may be of interest to some listeners that Section 215 of the Patriot Act, under which this surveillance of us all takes place, expires in June and must be renewed in order for this kind of government activity to continue. Those who care about such things may wish to make their opinions known to their congresspeople, and to do that pretty soon. In the meantime, it seems that a lot of people do care about such things, and market demand, as well as moral outrage, is generating more options for people who wish to keep their personal, health, or business messages private, which means that the only people who can read the messages or hear them are the people that they're sent to. And private means private not only from government surveillance, but from commercial exploitation and from hackers as well. One way that can happen is for users to choose to encrypt their messages, either via email, text, phone, or chat. While this ensures that the messages cannot be received except by people who have the decryption key, in the past most people found it too difficult to use encryption software. But that's beginning to change. Recent innovations in software such as CryptoCat enables secure chatting and even sharing of files on mobile devices, and is dead simple to use. The technology is open source and free. Like all encryption, of course, both the sender and the receiver have to be using the software. For those who use iPhones or Android devices, a recent upgrade of the open source Signal software enables end-to-end encryption of phone calls and text messages on iOS and Android smartphone systems. There are also new initiatives to make messages and data exchange more secure in web searches and in the cloud, and we'll look at some of those on future editions of Notes from the Electronic Cottage.